All right, Alexander, let's talk about the situation in Ukraine. The situation on the front line with the Russian forces continuing to advance. They are advancing very quickly in the direction of Zaporozhye, Guliapole, and in that direction. We have the encirclement and the capture of Pokrovsk. I think we can say that it's captured, even though the Ministry of Defense has not officially come out with a statement saying that Pokrovsk and Milnograd are captured. They effectively are captured. The Ukraine military was trying some sort of counterattack in that direction, but it looks like all those efforts have failed. And of course, you have what's happening in the north, in the Kharkov region, in Kupiansk. You also have activity in Lyman, in Siversk. And as all of this is happening on the front line, this Ukraine military collapse that we are seeing on the front line, Zelensky decided it's a good idea to go on a road trip.
Yeah.
And so that's what he did. He is on a European road trip. That is what his people are calling it. That's what the Western media is calling it. Zelensky's European road trip. And so he stopped over in Greece. He's in France. And I believe he is going to a lot more other countries to ask for money and for weapons and signing gas deals.
Yes. Yes.
Where do you want to begin?
Well, where do we begin? Let's begin a bit with the military situation, which you've actually described very well. I think that this is something that in the West, there is still a reluctance to accept the gravity of it. But what we're actually now looking at is something worse than, you know, setbacks, some places of on the front lines. It is beginning to look like an all-encompassing military crisis. If you go to the Ukrainian side of the internet, all the various reporters and bloggers and people of that kind, I mean, they are both in a state of panic and in a state of rage. Rage with Zelensky and Sivsky and the Ukrainian command, but also in panic about how bad things are. And, well, where to begin? I mean, Pokrovsk, I think you're absolutely correct. I think the town of Pokrovsk itself is now completely under Russian control. I don't think the Russian Ministry of Defense is going to announce that fact until the entire Pokrovsk cauldron, which includes the Ukrainian grouping in Mirnograd, has been cleared completely. But that is now only a question of time. In fact, from what I can see, that cauldron is being sealed tighter all the time. Half of it, apparently, the southern part of it, has now passed under Russian control. The Ukrainians are saying that it's passed into the gray zone. That means the contested zone. When the Ukrainians say that, you know, about 50% of the cauldron, former cauldron, is in the contested zone, what they really mean is that the Russians control it. So it seems to me that what we now have in Pokrovsk is a area in northwestern Mirnograd where there is a body of several hundred or perhaps several thousand Ukrainian troops surrounded. And that's the situation in Pokrovsk. We've discussed in many programs what would happen if Pokrovsk fell. We discussed it also with Scott of Calibrated, with whom we did a program, I think it was last week. The fall of Pokrovsk would be a decisive event because it would open the way for the Russians to advance west towards the Dnieper, towards the city of Pavlograd, which is also said to be a key logistics hub, this time to send supplies north to Kharkov region and places like that. Indeed, it's the city of Kharkov itself. But it would also, the fall of Pokrovsk would also put the Russians in a position where they could outflank and surround the Ukrainian troops in the two cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. In other words, surround fortified towns in Donbass. And the same is happening in the north. Again, reports say that all of Kupiansk is now basically under Russian control. The Russians have captured the industrial sector of Kupiansk, which is located on the east bank of the River Oskol, which flows through Kupiansk. The residential areas on the west side of the Oskol, which are on higher ground, are also under Russian control. There are some outlying suburbs to the south, including areas, by the way, of parks and woods, in other words, not built up areas, which are still being fought over. But that looks like it's essentially over. And well, before long, we will hear that the Ukrainian forces that are trapped, not in Kupiansk itself anymore, but apparently in fields that lie to the east of Kupiansk, that they will probably be forced to lay down their arms also. So those are the two places where the cauldrons have happened. But in a way, now this is really extraordinary, all of this is being overshadowed by what looks like the even greater disaster that is unfolding in the south. And again, if you go back to our program, the Scott of Calibrated, he talked about this. But things there are moving, I think, even faster than Scott of Calibrated was saying. The Russians now look like they're close to encircling the town of Gulyapolye. They have captured an important fortified village to the southeast of Orekhov, a village called Malaya Tokmachka, which is the village that the Ukrainians used as their base area for their summer 2023 offensive, which was supposed to break through to the Sea of Azov. With Malaya Tokmachka under Russian control, with Gulyapolye about to be surrounded, it looks impossible that Orekhov itself can hold, can be held by the Ukrainians for very long. That brings the Russians all the way up to Zaporozhye city itself. All of Zaporozhye falls under Russian control. That brings the Russians to the Dnieper. And the Russians are also advancing towards the Dnieper further north. They've about to capture another important fortified town called Novopavlivka. This was expected to be defended by the Ukrainians successfully, or at least for weeks or months. It appears to have collapsed almost immediately. And beyond all of that, there are increasing signs that a major crisis is also brewing for the Ukrainians at the north in Kharkiv. The Russians are about to finish the battle for the town of Volchansk. That will put them in control, it seems, of all the high ground around the city of Kharkiv itself. It's starting to look as if in a few weeks or months, the situation in Kharkiv region in the north is going to be as critical as the situation in Zaporozhye is. And all of this because the Ukrainian army is now desperately short of men. Its drones are outmatched by the Russian drones. The Russian Air Force is now bombing Ukrainian positions round the clock. They're producing 120,000 Fab bombs a day. The situation on the front lines, as I said, bears all the hallmarks of an early collapse.
So Zelensky is traveling Europe at this time. What do you make of that?
Well, it's what he always does when things start to go wrong. He's also, of course, got a political crisis in Kiev, which we've discussed many times with the corruption scandal there.
Well, we'll get to that.
It's
all connected. Everything
connects with everything else. So he's got that. He's also worried, no doubt, about the budget situation in Ukraine. The budget, Ukraine is spending double the amount of what it is earning from domestic taxation. In fact, I believe the real situation is much worse. The European Union is finding it increasingly difficult to get persuade people to move forward with its idea of appropriating Russian assets. We've discussed this many, many times, but now Euroclear are coming out and saying that they'll take legal action if anybody orders them to come up with one of these schemes, which shows how bitter and difficult this is becoming. And so what does Zelensky do? He's got problems on every side. So he flees Kiev, because that's really the man's thing. He runs away from Kiev. He goes and spends time with his friends. He meets Mitsotakis in Greece, who, of course, embraces him. I mean, it's incredible that political leaders across Europe continue to give Zelensky the time of day. But anyway, Mitsotakis promises that he's going to open up the routes for liquefied LNG, liquefied natural gas in the United States to go to Ukraine, as if that can help in any way. He's off to France. He signed some grand strategic partnership plan with Macron. He's on a road trip, as you say. No doubt he'll go to Brussels. Probably he'll meet his dear friend, Keir Starmer, who's also on the way out. And eventually, probably, he'll end up in Germany too, probably on his way back, and have another meeting with his other dear friend, Friedrich Merz. I mean, he is now among friends. So he feels safe. He feels comfortable. He's got all of their support, all of their friendship. He's got all of these promises, and far better to deal with that than a crisis in Kiev and a collapse on the battlefronts and an economy that's plunging towards collapse also.
Yeah, so his entertainment buddy, his one-time entertainment buddy, Mindich, has fled to Israel. Yeah. It looks like Umerov, the one-time defense minister, and now I believe he's president of the Security Council of the National Assembly or something like that. Anyway, he went to Turkey and then went to Qatar, and he hasn't been back in like 5-6 days. So it looks like he's bolted. Yeah. What's left for Zelensky in Kiev outside of mobilization of under 25? I'm just trying to think what does the West want of Zelensky? What more do they want of him? The mobilization of young kids, right?
Yes, that's all they have.
To continue to fight the conflict.
Yes, that's all that they have, because there isn't anything else. I mean, weapons supplies apparently are dwindling. Not because they don't want to give him weapons.
They can't.
They can't, exactly.
Well, maybe Norway might give the $140 billion. Yeah. What do you make of that? Well, the Norwegian wealth, the wealth fund.
Welfare fund, it's deplete Norwegian welfare fund. But, they might do that, give him a bit more money, get him through the crisis. I suspect even in Norway that he's going to run into some problems. I mean, Norway's sovereign wealth fund has been what Norway depends on for when, its oil revenues go, and it's been its great economic success. I think there'll be political problems with that. But then, Stoltenberg is the finance minister, prime minister now? I can't remember. I think he's the finance guy. So, of course, he's probably very keen to come up with this, because that's the one thing all the European leaders want to do, is that they want to go on writing checks for Zelensky. I mean, if their own countries go short, if Norway does away with its welfare fund, if France and Britain intensify their budget crisis, if Germany wants to go on running up more and more debt, well, that's fine, because we must keep our friend Zelensky going. We must keep him still running. But it's not going to change the situation. The military situation presents intractable problems, which Ukraine and the West cannot resolve. The former British military chief, Lord Richards, made that very same point. So all of this is throwing good money after bad, and it doesn't resolve the underlying problem. But One thing it might do, give 140 billion euros to Zelensky. If you can't get it from the Russian funds, plunder Norway's sovereign wealth fund and do that. Then what you've always talked about, close all the various positions in Kiev, pay off all of those people who still want their cut, pile up the money in the suitcases and go. I mean, that's probably all that's left. I think you did a post on X in which you said that the worse the situation becomes, the more the Europeans are basically cannibalizing everything that they have left just to keep this thing operating and going. And I think that's what that looks like. As for Umerov, well, of course, the reason he was sent to Turkey, the official reason, was to restart negotiations with the Russians on a prisoner exchange. This just a few days after Ukraine's deputy foreign minister told the Times that negotiations with Russia had been suspended until the end of the year. But then Umerov, you have to get him out of Kiev to prevent him answering questions or being asked questions. So you get him out of Kiev, you send him to Turkey. Then obviously negotiations in Turkey are proving sticky, perhaps because the Russians are making their own demands. So he goes off to Qatar, and some people are saying to the UAE, places where, let's be straightforward about it, there are all kinds of banks and financial institutions located in these two countries. Perhaps that's more important. Perhaps that's something that you need somebody to go to and in order to straighten out things there before the music stops.
Yeah, it's amazing that all these European leaders are still trying to funnel money to Zelensky even after this corruption scandal.
Yeah.
Which once again we've said many times is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of Zelensky. 100 million to Zelensky is a cup of coffee for him.
Yeah.
But still, you know, the gold toilet and bags of cash, like the Financial Times put it in their article, it has done a lot of damage to Zelensky. At least people outside of Kiev, outside of Ukraine, they're reading these articles and they're saying, okay, so this is where my money has been going, right? So it makes it harder for the Europeans to get money to Ukraine. I believe Donald Tusk said as much, but they still are trying to do it.
Yes.
Which is incredible. It's not only the Europeans that are friends with Zelensky. It's also Donald Trump, who's buddy-buddies with Zelensky. Yes. And he has announced that Congress is putting together what effectively sounds like an embargo. I mean, they're basically putting together legislation that will punish any country that does business with Russia and Iran. Trump was very, very proud of himself to say that Iran was his suggestion. Yeah. He's very proud of himself for suggesting Iran. But Russia and Iran, and it started with Russia, they're going to put together legislation which will punish any country for doing business with Russia.
Yeah.
That's an embargo.
Yeah. Lindsey Graham all over again. I mean, this is Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal.
And then you have all the articles which are running saying that that the inflation in the United States is due to Russia and the strikes on Russian energy. I mean, it seems like Trump has not gotten the memo that Ukraine is going to lose, and they're going to lose big. And he's going to take the L, and he's going to take the L in a very big way. But it's more escalation for him.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the course that he set himself on. And as you correctly said, the Europeans are busy writing up the checks. But before long, by the way, I would not be surprised if we start to see money checks again coming from the United States. Trump at the moment says that the United States is not giving any money to Ukraine. It's highly likely sooner or later that they will, just to say. I mean, it is extraordinary. It is baffling. The obsessive quality behind all of this is amazing. But there it is. And as I said, the military situation speaks for itself. Things are getting worse. There is now still this idea that if you increase economic pressure on the Russians that will somehow turn the situation. That's the narrative, the rationale that's been provided for all of these moves, even as every previous experience tells us that all that does is make the economic situation of the West worse and doesn't prevent the collapse in Ukraine that is coming.
What does an embargo mean, though, for the United States, for the world? What if they move forward and actually do pass this legislation? Trump said he's for it.
Yes, I know.
Trump said he's all for it. He supports it.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that more and more countries around the world are going to stop trading with the United States, or they're going to stop openly trading with the United States. They're going to start finding workarounds, because that is what they will have no real option but to do. It's not a question of liking the Russians or not liking the Russians. People need oil. People need grain. People need the kind of things that Russia has. These are indispensable things. And Russia is so integrated into world supply chains that it is impossible for countries to stop trading with Russia in the way that the United States, or at least some people in the United States, thinks. And anyway, just to repeat a point which we've made previously, Russia is a self-sufficient economy. It is a vast continental economy. It's self-sufficient in energy. It's self-sufficient in food. It's got a strong industrial base. It's got a strong scientific base. Trying to blockade Russia is a fool's idea. It cannot work. And of course, China will never agree to it. And as we've already seen, China has decisive leverage over the United States in relation to this. There's already, again, there's an article today in the Financial Times about the fact that the problem with the Nexpedia chips is completely unsolved. There's still massive shortages of those. They're devastating the European car industry. They're affecting the American car industry. And we've discussed the rare earth situation many, many times too.
And they're still obsessed with keeping this thing going. Mm. It's amazing. They all see that they're going to lose, but they just can't stop.
No.
Yeah. Including the United States, well, including President Trump. And the Russians, you know, just to also just mention the Russians are asked about Trump. After Trump says he wants to blockade and embargo Russia, what's the response from Russia? Well, you know, Trump is someone we can work with because he understands the root causes.
I know, yeah. I know.
Make sense. I don't know. Maybe this is just Russian diplomacy. I don't know. Maybe they're just...
Well, to be honest,
it's a bad look.
It is a bad look. For me, though, it is starting to get a kind of ritual quality.
Yeah.
These comments from the Russians, what one gets the sense that all conviction has been draining away. And Lavrov, who has clearly been authorized to do this, has been giving one interview and press conference after another, which it seems to me has been steadily destroying Trump's position. I mean, he's now given us a full account of what happened in Anchorage. We now have clear understanding of what happened between Putin and Trump when they last spoke on the telephone. We now know that the expectation in Moscow and effectively the promise Trump gave to Putin was after the call that he would speak to Zelensky and get Zelensky to accept Istanbul Plus, including the withdrawal from Donbass. And as we know, Trump caved to what Zelensky wanted. And, you know, we're getting more information from the Russians about all of this every day. And they're now coming back and they're saying that, yes, of course, we're prepared to meet Trump, but it must be on the basis of what we agreed with him in Anchorage. In other words, Istanbul Plus. In other words, now what could have been a deal had Trump gone ahead with it after Anchorage will come to be seen by most people as a capitulation.
Yeah. All right. We will end the video there, the Duran.locals.com. We are on X and Rumble and Telegram. And also look for us on Substack. There's a link to our Substack in the description box down below. Take care.